Bonjour, bienvenue donc au séminaire. I am very happy today to welcome Jenny Safran from University of Wisconsin in Madison. She came all the way, not from the States, but actually from Rome, where she's spending a sabbatical. Thank you very much for making the trip. I understand it's as cold in Rome as it is in Paris. Well, Jenny Safran is has a very interesting career dedicated to the possibilities and limits of statistical learning in infants, in particular in the domain of language. As I was looking this morning at her publication, there is one that stands out as an absolute bestseller in the science field. It's a paper in Science in 1996. With Dick Aslin and Elisa Newport. I'm sure we'll hear about it. If you haven't read this paper, which has now 2,000 citations, you should absolutely read it. I think it's a classic of learning in infants. But this work was only the beginning of a whole research career now dedicated, and a whole lab dedicated to statistical learning in infants. And so without further ado, I would like to hear what you have to say about beyond nature and nurture.
Merci beaucoup, je vous en prie. Je suis désolée de ne pas parler en français because my French is not very good. But I wish I could give this lecture in French. So I apologize in advance for my English. And also I apologize if I speak quickly. I'll try to pace my speaking. It's really a true privilege to have the opportunity to speak with you today. And I have to say that as I looked, I gave this title to Professor Dahan several months ago, and as I was working on the talk, I realized it was a kind of maybe an overreaching title. So really the title of my talk should be something a little bit more like this. Can you guys see the screen okay? Yeah, okay. My personal interest is very much in learning, and I do believe that learning is a bridge between nature and nurture, and I'll come back to that more at the end of my talk, but really the thrust of this talk is going to be about how studying learning, particularly in the earliest months and years of childhood, can really help us to illuminate those bridges between what comes factory installed in the child in the form of learning mechanisms and how they make use of the experiences they have in the world. And of course, the particular brand of learning that I am going to be talking about today is a term that we actually stole from the computer scientists who for a long time have been interested in the degree to which machine learning can avail itself of the statistical patterns that live in the world. In the work that Professor Dahan was referring to earlier, we stole this term to refer to what human learners might also be doing as they interact with the world. And this is a quite old idea. So if you look back at the linguistics of the first half of the 20th century, the structural linguists like Leonard Bloomfield, and Zelig Harris, whose life's work was dedicated to trying to describe how languages of the world work in the pre-Chomskyan era, what they were doing was actually looking across languages and noticing that there were certain things across languages that could tell you about structure, even if you don't know anything about the language. So you could look at the way sounds were patterned, the way words were patterned, and begin to figure out some of the kinds of structures that actually matter in languages, where the words are, what sounds actually belong to a given language, how the syntax begins to unfold in a given language. What we became interested in doing was asking about the degree to which learners, particularly very young learners who are engaged in learning their native language or languages in many cases, could harness some of the very simple statistical properties in the languages of the world to begin to find this kind of structure. And so to begin my talk today, I'm going to introduce you to baby Einstein here, who is sitting next to a very simple equation, much simpler probably than the ones that Professor Dahan was showing you a few minutes ago. The idea here is that one way that infants could discover structure in the world is to keep track of which events predict which other events. And a very simple way to figure out which events predict which other events is to compute some sort of transitional or conditional probability, namely that X is followed by Y more often, for example, than X is followed by Z. But you might want to condition this on how often one of those elements occurs in general. So you can compute the probability of that Y occurs given X by figuring out how often XY happens and conditioning that on how often X happens in the absence of Y and with Y. It turns out that even a really simple statistic like this has some interesting powers when you apply it to natural languages. So I'm going to give you an example that I've used many times, and it's actually kind of an embarrassing example for reasons I will explain in a moment. If you take English, and you want to keep track of how often certain sounds follow certain other sounds, you can begin to figure out where words begin and end. This is a huge problem for babies because we don't talk like this to babies, or to anyone, really. It would take forever. Our words are all glommed together. They're in a running stream of speech. And even very young learners, in order to learn anything about their native language, have to be able to break in and figure out where words begin and end. This is the process of word segmentation, finding where word boundaries are in fluent speech. And it turns out that statistical information, if babies can make use of it, could be very, very useful in this process. So here's my silly example. We're going to ask about how likely pr is to be followed by t in English. How likely is pr to be followed by t? It's pretty likely. I mean, let's think about other words in English that have the syllable pr in them. I should have used a French example today. I apologize. We have pretend, prevaricate, predilection. Most babies aren't hearing those. There are a few words, but in general, if you hear pr and you're a baby, you're going to hear teen next a lot of the time. Now, we can contrast that with the sequence t-bay, because in English, t can be followed by many, many things. We can have pretty shoes, pretty potatoes, pretty dress, teacup, so on and so forth. And so the idea here is that t is followed by bay relatively infrequently. And so a suitably equipped learner might be able to track that information and figure out, oh, pr and t kind of belong together. T and bay, no. So we're going to group those into separate words. The reason this is a slightly embarrassing example is I used it for several years in talks before I actually did the math. So I actually, at some point, realized I keep giving this example. I should actually compute these probabilities. So I took a corpus of 1 million utterances to babies under the age of 1. And I simply ask, what's the probability that if babies hear pr, they hear t next? I'm going to take your guesses. So if every time they hear pr, they hear t next, it would be, you know, 1.0, 100%. And if they never hear t after pr, it should be 0%. Any guesses between 1 and 0? What's the probability that if you hear pr, you'll hear t next if you're a baby? 1? 0.1? Point?
I would say 25%.
25%? So 0.25? It's actually pretty high. 80% of the time that they hear pr, they hear t next. Now here's the really interesting and embarrassing part of this example. The probability, what do you think is the probability that if a baby hears t, they're going to hear bay next? 100? Others?
15.
15? 15. 15. It's an embarrassing example for this reason. It's minuscule. The reason it's a bad example is it makes the problem look too easy. It makes it look like you always have high probabilities inside words and low ones across word boundaries. And of course, that isn't true. The reality is much more mixed. But nevertheless, the intuition is, to some extent, going to be valid, that in general, sequences that happen inside words are more likely to predict one another than sequences across word boundaries. So what we wanted to ask in our original work, and I'll use the original work as a way to launch the rest of the talk, was whether infants are actually sensitive to these regularities? Can babies who are just starting to break into the babbling stream of speech that surrounds them use this type of information to chop words into something like units? So what we did was we played babies something like this.
Go pilato ki booty poluto ki boogie.
I'll play that again. It's pretty fabulous stuff.
Eco bato ki boogo pilato ki booty poluto ki boogie.
We wanted to ask whether the infants could track the statistical patterns that live in speech that sounds like that. So let me explain to you a little bit more about what we did. The babies listened to this. Okay, so they listened to a stream that looked like this. It didn't look like anything, that sounded like this. But there was structure inside the stream. So even though it was just a monotone sequence of syllables, there was actually internal structure to it. Certain syllables predicted other syllables with high regularity. So for example, the sequence tokibu in this particular language, I should note I am the only native speaker of this language. It has no meaning. It's a very weird language. Every time the babies heard to, it was followed by ki. Every time they heard ki, it was followed by bu. So very strong information telling them that there's a coherent structure there. We can contrast that with something like bu-gi-ko, which I'm going to call a part word. A part word is a sequence that goes across a word boundary, like ti-bei in the pretty baby example I gave a moment ago. Babies have heard bu-gi-ko, but there's a dip in the probability. So the probability in this case, in this particular language, from bu to gi drops to 0.33, to 33%, because bu could be followed by gi, but it could also be followed by go, or it could be followed by something else. I can't find it off the top of my hand, off the top of my head, but it's in there somewhere. So what we did was we asked whether babies could learn anything about this structure by solely just having them listen. And here's how we did this. We used a preferential listening and looking procedure. I'll show you a video of it in a moment, but I'm first going to mock it up with my hands. So these are 8-month-old babies. They're sitting on their parents' lap in a very quiet little room. And in front of the babies and on both sides, we have little motorcycle lights. Nowadays, it's a computer monitor, but back in the day, it was motorcycle lights that we blink to get their attention at specific times. And there are audio speakers on both sides of the baby. The experimenter is outside the room watching the whole thing on a closed-circuit TV camera. So at the beginning of the experiment, the baby's sitting there, and she'll hear tokibu babu poo pigo la babu poo tokibu for 2 minutes. And she just sits and listens. Lights are blinking, following her gaze, but they're not really important. At the end of the 2 minutes, she's starting to get a little squirrely, a little bored. It's not the most interesting thing in the world. And the room will go silent, and we'll blink the center light to get her attention. When she looks at, and we do that because otherwise we don't want to start a trial while the baby's trying to eat her sock or grab the headphones off the parent or something like that. When the center light blinks, the baby will look to the center light because a really nice thing about babies is they like blinking lights. When the baby's looking at the center light, the computer extinguishes that light and starts to blink a light on one side of the room. The room is still silent. When the baby looks at that light, they'll start to hear a test item that's either a word from the speech or a part word from the speech. So they start to hear something like, go pila, go pila, go pila, go pila, and it continues as long as the baby fixates that light. When the baby looks away, the computer gives them 1 second to look back, and if they don't look back, the light's turned off, the sound turns off, and that center light turns on again. So the baby controls the structure of the experiment. The baby controls how long each test item plays, and our dependent variable is whether babies listen differently to sequences that had good statistics, that were words in the speech, versus sequences that had weaker internal statistics, that were part words. So here's a video. It's a little, it's an old video, and you'll see it sort of is a little weavy towards the beginning, but I'll narrate as we get closer to where you can see the baby's behavior. Okay, the center light's on. Side light.
Go labu, go labu, go labu, go labu, go labu, go labu.
center light, side light.
Mulatto, 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 mulatto.
This way. Mulatto, comes back quickly, mulatto, so it keeps going.
Mulatto, mulatto, mulatto.
And he's done with that trial. Okay, so the infant is in control in this method. And what we found in this study and in many, many, many other studies across many labs is that infants and kids and adults and monkeys and rats are sensitive to these sorts of very simple statistical regularities, not just in speech, but also in sequences of tones. So when we play babies tone sequences that have the same structure but are made out of notes, so something like do-do-do-do-do-do-do, where a word is do-do-do, we see the same kinds of learning emerging. This seems to be a fairly robust ability and possibly a fairly evolutionarily old ability because it's observed in other species as well. So I would say at this point, I couldn't have said this 10 years ago, but I can say at this point, there's some consensus that I think people agree these abilities exist. The more interesting question to me is, what are they for? And that's what I want to talk about for the bulk of my talk today. We know that learners can track these statistics. They do so implicitly in the absence of instruction across many domains. The more interesting question to me, particularly as someone who studies language acquisition, is what are they for? Are learners just tracking these things but not ever making any use of them? Or are they actually tracking these statistics in language and using them when acquiring language? So that's what I'm going to talk about now. Let me clarify what I mean by my question with a particular study that I think will help to explain what I mean. So I referred to this process of word segmentation, the idea that babies are hearing gola, boo, padi, koo, tu, ti, boo, ba, boo, poo, and finding words in continuous speech. But we don't actually have any evidence from what I've told you thus far that they're learning anything about words. What we have evidence for is that they can discriminate between sequences with good statistics and sequences with less good statistics, which is still really interesting and really possibly very important. But it doesn't tell us that they've done anything linguistically interesting. So in the study I want to tell you about now, we decided to try to ask whether babies were actually treating these sequences that they're hearing in fluent speech that have good statistics as words or as possible words. What's a word? People actually argue a lot about what counts as a word, but from the perspective of a baby, a reasonable hypothesis is that a word is a sound sequence that is going to have a meaning or is going to be linked to a meaning. So what we asked in this particular study was whether babies who have heard something like gola, boo, pabi, ku, tu, ti, boo, et cetera, take the sequences that were words in that speech as possible candidates for real words that are going to be linked to objects. So let me explain to you what we did to try to test this hypothesis. In this study, these were slightly older babies. I think they were, maybe 17 or 18 months old, because 8-month-olds aren't that great at learning words, but 17 and 18-month-olds are. And what we did, this was work by my then graduate student, Katie Graf Estes. She developed a pretty complicated task where instead of just giving babies exposure to fluent speech and then a test with head turning, this is a three-phase task that involves mapping labels to meanings as well. At the beginning of the study, the babies listened to something like this, that of course had a structure to it. So there were words in the speech, there were two-syllable words in this particular study, like time and dobu. There were also part words. These were sequences, again, that span word boundaries. And crucially in this particular design, this will turn out to be very important, the sequences like ga ti that span a word boundary, the part words, were just as frequent in the speech as the words. But they had lower probabilities of co-occurrence. So the probability of ga being followed by ti was 0.5, whereas ti to me is 1.0. Okay, so first they hear this fluent speech for a couple minutes. Then instead of testing them, they get dumped into a word learning task immediately. So they now see images like this, and they hear something like time, 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 time. That might be the first trial. When they look away, then they see something like this. Dobu, 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 dobu. And what we're using here is a habituation method. What that means is that we're trying to get them bored, which is always a great thing to do in an experiment with babies, but we are intentionally trying to get them bored. So we alternate between time trials and dobu trials, and slowly the babies start looking less and less on each trial because they've seen it, they've learned something about it, until their looking time drops to half of what it was at the beginning. This is our habituation criterion. This tells us that the babies have taken what they are going to take from this experience, and we're ready to move on. At the end of habituation, we use a testing method that was developed by Janet Worker and Les Cohen called the same switch method. And the logic behind this test is very simple. It's a test of word learning. The trials are either what we call same trials or switch trials. On same trials, the babies see exactly what they saw during training. So they'll see, I have to remember what they were, this donut-y kind of thing, and they'll hear dobu, 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 or they'll see that pokey thing and hear time. We know that they've gotten bored of these, right? So we expect them to stay bored on these same trials. The switch trials, they see exactly the same objects and hear the same words, but we swap them. So now that donut-y kind of article, object, is called a time, and the sort of spiky one is called a dobu. The logic here is that if they've learned the linking between the sounds and the objects, then they should actually dishabituate. They should be more interested when we violate the pairings that they've learned, and they should show longer looking times to switch trials than to same trials. That's the logic. So what we had manipulated in this study, though, was whether the labels were words in the fluent speech or part words in the fluent speech. So for half of the babies, dobu was a word in the fluent speech they heard at the beginning. For the other half of the babies, dobu was a part word. And what we found was that that had a really, it had a major effect on what they learned during testing. So for babies for whom time and dobu were words in the fluent speech, they looked longer on the switch trials. They showed us evidence that they had learned what time meant and what dobu meant. However, for babies for whom time and dobu were part words in the fluent speech, sequences spanning word boundaries, although equally frequent, they had heard time and dobu just as often, but they had weaker internal statistics, the babies failed to detect the switch. They showed us no evidence that they were able to learn what time and dobu meant. Again, despite having heard those words, those sequences, just as often in the fluent speech. And so we take this as suggesting that the statistical learning process, at least in the domain of language, is rendering something we've called candidate words, forms, sound sequences that are being pulled out and are now available for mapping to meaning for these infants. So this suggests to us that babies aren't just tracking these statistics and then forgetting about them. Instead, that what they're doing is a more cascading dynamic process where as sequences are pulled out of speech, they're then available for use in subsequent learning. They're then available for use, in this case, as labels for objects. Now that's all fine and good, but some of you are probably thinking, okay, but these are really weird situations you're putting the babies in, and you're giving them some really weird stuff to learn. We don't talk to babies like Tigola, pabuku, tutibu, and if we did, our babies would probably cry a lot and really not like us very much. These particular languages have a lot of problems. So we intentionally chose to use artificial nonsense languages for experimental control. So we knew exactly what we were giving the babies to learn from. But it seems quite possible that the kind of learning that I've talked about thus far maybe isn't very language-like at all because we're not really giving them anything language-like to learn from. So there are a number of ways that we have tried to pursue this problem of asking whether statistical learning has anything to do with real language learning. And I'm going to give you a couple examples of, from each of these different approaches today. The first, and perhaps most obvious, and maybe where we should have started to begin with, is to use real languages instead of artificial languages. Although I'm actually, there are pluses and minuses both ways. I think it's probably better to have started with the stripped down artificial ones, but we might have avoided a lot of criticism if we'd started with real languages. So, in our first study along these lines, I was fortunate to have a sabbatical visitor from Italy in my lab, and she proposed developing Italian materials with our Wisconsin babies, who obviously don't speak Italian, to ask whether they could track transitional probabilities in natural speech from an unfamiliar language. And so the design of this study, I'll walk you through the design in some detail, because it's a little, just slightly different than the studies I've told you about before. Again, we used 8-month-old babies. For 2 minutes, just like in our Gola Bu Pabi Ku studies, they heard speech, but now it's pretty awesome infant-directed real speech.
Gusto i bigoli dentro casa o coricato all'ombra del melo verde. Per ascoltare la fuga, quasi cadi sul melo e inciampi sulla birra sull'erba. Torno a casa con le bici cariche di frutta e bilico sulla sella. La zia Carola si è esibita in...
Lot nicer to listen to. After 2 minutes of this exposure, we then test babies using the same head-turning procedure I told you about at the beginning of the talk, but now instead of contrasting words and part words, we're going to contrast two different kinds of words that occurred in the speech that we played the babies. We're going to contrast words that we call high transitional probability words, where the probability from the first to second syllable is perfect, 1.0, with low transitional probability words, where the first syllable predicts the second syllable only 1/3 of the time. Crucially, these words happen equally often in the speech that the babies hear. Now, let me walk you through a few features of this design. The first has to do with just showing, trying to, you know, impress upon you that this is, in, on the face of it, a harder task. So in our original studies, this is sort of our phonological inventory, very few different sounds, they're all the same syllable structure. There are only 4 words in the entire corpus for 2 minutes, and they heard each of those words 45 to 90 times. In the current Italian corpus, you can see there's a much richer inventory of phonemes, much richer inventory of syllables, and different lengths of syllables, and they hear each word that we're going to test them on only 18 times. So this is, it's still a little more dense in terms of repetitions than natural speech to infants, but it's a lot less dense than hearing the same 4 words 90 times. Here's how the corpus worked. So here's our corpus. Let's start with the word melo. So melo is one of our high transitional probability words in this condition. Every time the babies hear me, it's followed by lo. Similarly, we have the word fuga. Every time the babies hear fu, it's followed by ga. We can contrast that with casa in this particular condition. So they hear casa just as often as they'd heard melo or fuga, but they also hear the syllable ka 12 additional times in other words. And what that does is drop the transitional probability from ka to za and kaza, because now ka is being followed by lots of other things in this language. Similarly, we have the word bici. They hear b followed by chi, however many times, as 6 times, but they also hear b followed by other things 12 times. So the probability from b to chi is just 0.33. So just to lay out this design for you, of course it's counterbalanced. I should have said in all of our studies, it's always counterbalanced. So the sequences that are words for half the babies are part words for the other half and vice versa. But just to highlight this design, just consider the babies in language A. We have fuga and melo, as I mentioned before. These are high transitional probability words. Every time they hear fu, it's followed by ga. And bici and casa are low transitional probability words. So the probability from the first syllable to the second syllable is only 0.33. But crucially, they hear the high and low transitional probability words an equal number of times during our exposure. And what we found, and I have to say, this is one of these studies where when we started to run it, I thought, there is no way the babies can do this. I can't do this. This seems really, really hard. There's so much going on in this speech. But the babies were actually able to do this just fine, suggesting that this ability to track statistical properties of fluent speech is not just an artifact of using weird monotone languages, but it emerges when we give babies real languages as well. And indeed, I would go so far as to say that using rich natural language structure with redundant cues, with multiple cues to word boundaries, is only going to help babies relative to our artificial language materials. And of course, those of you who are in this field know that there's many decades of work now showing that babies are adept at using the features of infant-directed speech to help them find word boundaries. In our own work, we've added to that by showing that features of infant-directed speech help babies with tracking the statistical properties of the speech that they hear. I won't take the time to go through these examples, but for example, when you talk to babies like go la bu ti bo fa, and you add a lot of pitch, they learn more than when you have flat pitch. When you change the utterance lengths, when you make some utterances short, just one word and others long, babies learn the statistics of the speech better as well. And moreover, it turns out that there are features of the speech that babies are tracking that many of us would never imagine they're tracking. So it turns out that when babies are keeping track of these transitional probabilities, I've always described it to you in terms of forward probabilities. That is the probability that ba is followed by b, or ka is followed by za, like kaza. It turns out that they do it backwards too. So they're also tracking the probability that b was preceded by ba. So they're tracking probabilities in both directions as they're listening to fluent speech. So they're really harnessing a tremendous amount of information that lives in the speech that's flowing over them. Now, the next obvious question for us was whether babies can go beyond just tracking these probabilities to actually using them in language learning. And so what we wanted to do was exactly the same study that I told you about before, where we had words like dobu and time, and we mapped them to novel objects, except now we used our Italian corpus. So we played for the babies, again, these are slightly older babies, our sequences of torno la bici, la casa, da, 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 I can't even do it very well. And then we put them into the word learning task, where they heard casa mapped to a novel object, or bici mapped to a novel object. And we manipulated whether those labels were high transitional probability sequences or words or low transitional probability words. And what we found was the same pattern of results. Babies were better at mapping the sounds onto their reference, onto meanings, when those sound sequences had better internal statistical structure. So when we had better internal statistics in the fluent speech that the babies had heard in Italian, we saw better learning of the label-object pairings. And so, and in this study, because now we knew to think about backwards transitional probabilities, we were able to show that if we took away the forward transitional probability information so that it wasn't a good predictor of word structure, babies could use the backward probability structure alone as a good cue and use those labels, use those sequences to map to objects, even without forward transitional probability information. So I feel like this is one of these areas where, as we discover more about what babies are capable of tracking, now we, in our experimental designs, have to be thinking more and more about types of information that live in the speech stream that we never imagined babies had access to begin with. More generally, these results, I think, support the idea that there's a cascading effect of not just sequential statistical learning, but of all learning, and that what babies are learning at time one is going to change the types of information they have access to at time two. Okay, so I suggested that another route that we could take to trying to figure out what these statistical learning processes have to do with real language learning is to continue to use more complicated artificial languages, continue to use artificial languages, but make them richer and more complex in ways that might map onto other aspects of natural language structure. And so to give you an example of that, I'm going to tell you about a study that we did that is now no longer looking at word segmentation, finding words in fluent speech, but instead looking at the process of learning how words fall into categories in any language. So for example, we know that there are statistical cues that help learners figure out things like nouns and verbs, figure out which words cohere into the categories of their native language. So for example, taking these English words here, you can notice that the words that are verbs happen to end in ing in these examples, and the words that are nouns happen to end in the phoneme e in these examples. These are cues that could help learners break up words into categories. And it turns out that there are a number of different cues that learners can use to discover categories. And there's been a lot of work on this topic. Different languages weight these cues differently, but they seem to use some combination of these correlated cues. I'll use an English example. There are distributional cues. So in English, if I say something like a blicket, you're going to be pretty sure that blicket is a noun or maybe an adjective, but it's not going to be a verb. Having these particular words come before a new word tells you something about its category. In French, if you hear le ou la, you know that the next thing is going to be a noun or an adjective. Similarly, different languages have these phonological cues. So there are sound patterns that clump together, and they're not perfect cues, but they certainly could help you. If I said something like blicky, you'd be more likely to guess that it's a noun than a verb. And so the idea here is that languages carry correlated cues, none of which are that perfect or that great, but together could help learners to start breaking up categories of the words that they hear. And in work with infant learners, Rebecca Gomez and Luann Gerken and their colleagues have shown that if you make up little artificial languages that have this characteristic to them, statistical properties where there are phonological cues and distributional cues to category membership, that babies can learn structures of this sort. So in this particular language, which I'll be coming back to, there are two cues to category membership. This category, the words are preceded by erd and ong, and they're all bisyllabic. And in this category, I'll just call it the blue category for ease. In the blue category, alt and ush come first, and the target words are monosyllabic. And Gomez and colleagues have found that when you create a structure like this, babies are actually able to learn some sort of category structure and to generalize. But there's a lot more to words and to word categories than just these sort of statistical patterns. I mean, when we think about word categories, the first thing we think of is meaning, right? It might be imperfectly correlated, but even my little kids know that, you know, if I stick a or the before something, it's probably going to refer to some sort of an object, probably not a proper noun, some sort of an object. Whereas these things, the blue category in English here, is going to refer to actions of some sort. So word categories in real languages are more than just a collection of statistical patterns. They also relate to reference. They relate to something in the world. And learners have to learn that as well. So what we wanted to ask in the study I'm going to tell you about now is whether experience with these statistical patterns, experience just hearing certain sound patterns and hearing certain words arrayed in particular orders, can that facilitate learning something about meaning? And can that facilitate learning something about meaning that you can generalize to new members of the category? Because that's really what categories are for, is giving you an ability to generalize. So this study also follows one of these three-phase designs, where first babies are going to listen to something new, then we're going to train them on links between particular sounds and particular meanings, and then we're going to test them. This test procedure is a little bit different. So let me tell you first about the auditory familiarization in this particular task. We have two conditions. In one condition, in the experimental group, we're going to give babies really good cues to category membership, great statistical correlated cues. And so they're going to hear a structure that's just like the one I described to you a moment ago. They're going to hear these sequences for a couple of minutes at the beginning of the study, and they follow this nice categorization promoting pattern. We're going to contrast them with a control group. These babies hear exactly the same words, but they're now arrayed into patterns that don't have good category structure. So you can't generalize anything like erd and ong are followed by bisyllabic words, because sometimes they are, but sometimes they're not. There's still structure. They're still hearing a particular sequence of words, but you can't split them up into two categories the same way as you can in the experimental group. Crucially, though, in this design, there are certain items that are the same across both conditions. And it's those items that we're going to use for the next two phases of the study. Okay? So, after babies have listened to these words for a little while, we then train them using novel objects. Half of the objects are going to come from the category animal, and half of the objects come from the category vehicle. For babies in this condition, words that begin with ong or erd and have two syllables are going to refer to animals. And babies who hear words that are preceded by alt and ush and are monosyllabic are going to have those trained as vehicles. But crucially, babies in both conditions, the experimental condition and the control condition, get exactly the same training here. So from this point forward, the experiment is identical for all of the babies. The interesting question is whether that initial auditory familiarization is going to have any effect. We then test babies using an eye gaze paradigm, where they're going to see two objects on the screen, and we're going to track their eye gaze when they hear one of them labeled. So the babies are going to hear something like ong loga, these two objects on the screen. I think loga referred to this guy. And so we're going to see whether their eyes, after they hear ong loga, or while they're hearing ong loga, move to the little guinea pig. And so here's just a video of a baby in this sort of a task, and you can see what their eye movements look like. Pretty engaged. Our dependent variable here is where are they looking when? So, the first kind of test trials I'm going to tell you about are these familiar trials where they're seeing two objects that they've seen before, and one of them is being labeled correctly. Okay? So, ong loga, and if they don't know where to look, they should be at 50%. This is the onset of the speech, and a little while into it, we give them, they have like 360 milliseconds to launch a saccade. At this point, if they know where to look, their eyes should start going to the target. So higher numbers here mean more accurate looks. And these are the experimental babies, the ones who had the good category structure and the auditory familiarization at the beginning. And they learn the words. They know that when they hear loga, they should look to the guinea pig thing. They're not doing great, but they're doing better than chance. And they're doing better than, they're certainly more reliable than they were before they started hearing the word. But the really interesting thing is these control babies. They had just as much training that loga meant guinea pig. Loga means guinea pig. Loga means guinea pig. They saw it just as many times. And yet there's no evidence that they learned that word meaning pairing. So this suggests that hearing the words structured at the beginning of the study, just hearing them in an organized structure facilitated this later learning. Now, we then ran a more interesting, I think, test, where instead of just testing them on word-object pairs they'd already seen, like on loga, we tested them using objects they had never seen. So we're going to test them on these generalization trials on a vehicle they've never seen and an animal they've never seen. And we're going to have them listen to something like alt-deech, which they heard at the very beginning of the experiment, but was never used as a label for the objects. And we're going to ask whether the babies learned that Words that have alt before them and are monosyllabic tend to, in this case, refer to vehicles. Now, we haven't trained this word, so they're going to have to guess. And the interesting question is whether they make the right guess. Do they use the category knowledge to make the appropriate guess? And here are the data. Same kind of structure. The experimental babies make the right guess. They're later to do it than they were in the previous study, but they get there. The control babies don't. So these data suggest, we think, that the kind of listening experience that babies are having all the time, even when we're not labeling objects for them and giving them very sort of structured experience, all that language that's flowing over them all the time is facilitating downstream learning, is facilitating learning something, in this case, as complex as two different categories of objects. So what is so interesting here, in this particular task, just having a pairing between a label and an object wasn't enough. The task was too hard for that. The control babies, even though they saw loga and guinea pig, they didn't learn it. Only the babies in the experimental condition, who were sort of set up to expect some sort of category structure, were able to make those sorts of mappings and then to generalize those mappings as well. And indeed, we followed up these results. My former postdoc, Jill Laney, found in a follow-up study that different babies are actually using different information to solve this task. Interestingly, she found that babies who have a larger native language vocabulary, so babies whose parents report they know more words in English, were more likely to prioritize the distributional cue, the fact that certain words were preceded by alt or ush, whereas the low vocabulary babies, the babies whose parents report they know fewer English words, were more likely to focus on the probably simpler phonological cue, is the word one syllable or two syllables. So there's more to explore there. I'll skip the next bit and just say on the end of the slide that it does seem to be the case that what babies have learned about one domain really of language or reference or meaning or statistics seems to really influence what they're able to pull out of the next one. Now, I want to turn to the last part of my talk, which is going to focus on how we might use individual differences in real-life learning to help us understand what might be going on in these lab tasks and whether the lab tasks tell us anything about real-life language learning. And this work focuses on atypical learners. And there are, we actually have a lot of other studies going on, but what I'm going to tell you about today are just two published studies from our lab that we've done, looking at, in one case, statistical learning, and in the second case, we're not far enough along yet to even begin to look at something as complicated as statistical learning, just simply language processing in children who are not learning in a typical way. So let me begin by telling you about the statistical learning task in atypical learners. The population of interest here are children who are diagnosed with something that's called specific language impairment. Specific language impairment is a sort of blanket diagnosis for children who seem to be fine, except that their language is a couple standard deviations below normal. So they seem to be fine in nonverbal IQ and other sorts of aspects of behavior, but they're language disordered. And there's a lot of argumentation about just how specific language impairment is. And this particular task, what we did was we gave, these were 7 to 11-year-old children, our golabu, pabi, kututibu kind of task, but a version that we have that's more complicated that we use for children and adults. And instead of having them turn their heads and look at blinking lights, they have to do a forced choice test, where on each trial they hear a word paired with a sequence of syllables from the language in an order they've never heard before, and they have to indicate which one sounds more similar to the language they've been listening to. And we're going to compare here children with specific language impairment, SLI, to children who are matched for chronological age and for nonverbal IQ. In the first study that we did, they listened to this language for 20 minutes, and we found, maybe not surprisingly, but kind of sadly, that while the children with typical development, the CA group, chronological age match group, did fine, did better than chance, the children with SLI did not. They were unable to distinguish between the sequences that had good statistical properties in the speech they'd heard versus sequences that had never appeared in that order in the speech that they heard. But at that point, we didn't know whether it was that they couldn't do the learning or whether it was that they couldn't understand the test. Maybe there was something about the test demands, having to distinguish between these two pair, these pairs on each trial that they couldn't do. So in the next study with them, we doubled the exposure. We gave them 40 minutes of exposure to the speech and then tested them. And what we found is that while these children didn't do great, they actually did better than chance. So I know it doesn't look like it from this graph, but this is actually significantly better than chance and not significantly different than the chronicle age match kids. So that, I guess, was sort of encouraging. It wasn't that they couldn't do the test. They could do the test, but they seemed to be slower at picking up the structure of these statistics than the chronicle age match controls. Now, in the last study, I mentioned toward the beginning of my talk that we and many others have been interested in the degree to which these statistical learning processes in sequential input are just for language or whether they're also used for other domains of information as well. And so what we did was we took a version of our task that was made up of musical tones. So it sounds like, I think I sang it before, but exactly the same statistics, but instead of syllables, notes. And we thought, well, if this challenge is really specific to language, then maybe they'll be fine at this task. But despite 40 minutes of exposure, the children with specific language impairment were at chance. They were unable to distinguish between sequences that had occurred in the tone stream versus sequences that had not occurred in the tone stream, which was quite surprising to us. And so there's certainly a lot of interest in continuing to ask about the domain specificity or not of this challenge that these learners seem to have with tracking sequential information. I will say that we have another study with infants that I think is consistent with what we found with the children with SLI. This was a recent study that we did of word learning in 18-month-olds. And we wanted to ask about an aspect of sequential statistical structure that we see in real languages. And that's a feature of languages called phonotactics, which is a fancy word for regularities with which different sounds are allowed to follow one another in languages. And so what we did was we trained babies on labels for objects that were either phonotactically legal in English, like dref and sloob, which are perfectly good possible English words, versus sequences that use the same sounds but reordered to be illegal. So dlef and sroob are actually illegal English words. They're not possible English words. And what we found was that the infants who had good English vocabularies, according to parental report, only learn the legal labels. So they seem to be able to make use of these statistics that live in English that we know that even 9-month-old infants are sensitive to. These babies were able to use them to help them figure out what's a good word. But interestingly, the low vocabulary babies only learned the illegal labels. So they couldn't learn that dref and sloob were labels for words, but they could learn that dlef and sroob were, suggesting, we think, that not only were they unable to harness the native language statistics very well, but that these sort of pop out as sounding pretty salient. They're unusual sounds, and we think that's why the low vocabulary babies were able to learn them. Okay, one last study. The last study I'm gonna tell you about is, again, it's not gonna be a learning study, but it's a processing study, and we were interested in this population of children because these are deaf babies with cochlear implants. There's a lot of, I don't know what it's like in France, but in the United States, there's a lot of argumentation about cochlear implants, which they're a form of electrical hearing that is intended to try to restore aspects of auditory processing to individuals who are deaf. And for children who are born deaf, they can be implanted in the US as young as 12 months. I know some parts of Europe it's 6 months. I don't know what it's like here. But there, interestingly, seems to be a huge amount of variability in how they do. So some kids who are implanted, when you later do standardized testing on them, they do really, really well at learning English or French or whatever. Other children really, really struggle, and they don't succeed very well at learning a spoken language. But all of the work in this domain, with very few exceptions, has used parental report and standardized testing. And so we know very little about what's actually going on in these babies as they're trying to learn language. So what we did was use a very simple task adapted from work by Dan Swingley and Anne Fernald and Dick Aslan. And babies simply saw a display like this and heard something like this.
Can you find it?
Didn't play. Sorry, I was supposed to say, where's the ball? Can you find it? On half of the trials, the babies heard this in silence with no background sound, which is how we usually do our studies, but which is pretty unusual in the real world. The other half of the trials, they heard background talking. Someone was talking in the background 10 decibels quieter than the target speech, and we wanted to see whether they'd look to the right place. And so these are 2-year-olds with cochlear implants. Here's our first little guy that we tested. He actually has 2 implants. Many of the kids that we tested have 2 implants. So you can't hear what he's hearing, but you can see how involved he is in the task. And again, we're tracking their eyes to see if they look to the right place when the words are labeled. And so what we did, he's all over that. With this sort of test, there are 2 different kinds of measures you can take. You can take an accuracy measure, namely, do they look at the ball when you say, where's the ball? And you can take a reaction time measure, which is, if they happen not to be looking at the ball, how quickly do their eyes move to the ball when it's labeled? So I'm going to show you these data broken down in terms of hearing status. So NH is going to refer to normal hearing, and CI is for the children with cochlear implants. Again, these are 2-year-olds. And we're going to compare also how they do in quiet speech and with competitor speech in the background, with this background talking. And I'll first show you the data from the normal hearing group. What you can see is that there's some variability, but they're good at this task, and they should be. They're 2, and we're labeling words like ball and shoe. It's pretty easy for them. And there is an effect of having competitor speech. So they do a little bit worse when there's talking in the background. The children with the cochlear implants, though, there are a lot of things to say about it, but in short, there's a main effect of being deaf. So these children are much less accurate in recognizing these words. But there's also tremendous variability. So some of these kids look as good as our normal hearing kids, and others are way down, have no idea where to look when they're hearing these words labeled. The second thing we can look at here is time course. We can look at reaction time. And it's just like the data I was showing you before. I'll start with the normal hearing kids. So they hear, look at the doggy, and as soon as they possibly can start moving their eyes to the picture of the doggy, they're moving, and they're fast, and they get there fast. The kids with cochlear implants, though, they get there, sort of, but the slope is less positive, and they don't get nearly as high as they the typical kids do. Looking at the kids with competitor speech, you can see that the kids, the normal hearing kids with competitor background speech, look kind of like the cochlear implant kids, and the cochlear implant kids with competitor speech don't look like they understand these words at all. So what I take away from this study, if we look at the reaction times, the children with cochlear implants are running about between 200 and 400 milliseconds behind the kids with normal hearing at 2 years of age. If at 2 years of age, you're 200 to 400 milliseconds behind, you're running a syllable to 2 syllables behind your hearing peers. And so you can kind of just begin to imagine how challenging the process of processing speech and learning speech is going to be when you're always running behind. And so I think there's a lot more to be understood here, but this is a first look, and I think a quite sobering look, for me at least, in terms of what these children are able to do in the lab. All right, let me conclude. I don't think any of you would have doubted this, but in case you did before you walked in the door, infants are quite remarkable language learners, and I know that other speakers in this series will have certainly made the same point. They're tracking these statistical patterns implicitly. We don't give them instructions. We don't bring them into the lab and say, find the words. These seem to be very natural types of learning processes for them. And more importantly, they seem to be able to use and harness the statistical patterns that live in language and live in other domains in our world for subsequent learning. The end of the talk, I hope to have suggested that while most work in studying developmental disabilities has more focused on standardized testing and parental report, we believe that by trying to use our laboratory methods, we can get a much more nuanced picture of what they're able to do. And to return to my grandiose title at the beginning, I think that learning really is a bridge between thinking about nature and thinking about nurture, because you can't do learning unless you have learning mechanisms in place and able to harness the rich experience in the world. But of course, it's that rich experience that gives them something to do. And so it's my hope that as more and more of us start to take learning seriously, we'll continue to make real progress on some of the questions that have long captivated our imaginations. So let me end by thanking the people who actually do the research, my students and my lab mates, and of course the people who pay for the research, and finally, of course, the children and their parents, without whom none of this work would be possible. Thank you for your attention.